from March day and night
by the big cooling tower. They have the plans, but we have the power.
Welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with
Luke Savage. Welcome back, everyone.
I'm feeling a little down in the dumps because we're having a very aggrieved conversation about current events just off mic. A very sad conversation about what the world's come to. And, you know, in this episode, I have some lighter matters to discuss. Did you see the New York Times profile of Matt Farley this weekend?
I didn't read it, but I did see it. Congrats to friend of the show, Matt Farley.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure many, maybe even most listening to this know who he is. But for those who don't, he is the New England-based songwriter slash filmmaker who is notable, among other things, for having written 25,000 songs on Spotify, which through the accrual of many pennies, he makes into a living wage. But also, to some of us, to a smaller number of us, he and his friend Charlie Roxburgh are great filmmakers who have made this very impressive body of work as backyard productions. And I will not rest until he has his retrospective on the Criterion Channel, which I think will happen. But we did an episode on Magic Spot. I think it was called Moturn and Us a few months ago.
This is maybe treading old ground for older listeners. But if you're a new listener, you may not know that my esteemed co-host Will Sloan has actually played a not negligible role in putting Matt Farley's cinema on the map. I've only seen, I think, two of Matt Farley's movies, but they are remarkable, unique, unusual, absolutely worthy of, wider discussion, wider viewing. And Will, you published a book called Moturn on Moturn that was a series of interviews with you and Justin DeClue, co-host of your other podcast, The Important Cinema Club. If people haven't listened to that, do check it out. Will does have another podcast, and as much as I resent that, as much as I may resent that, I must concede that it's pretty good, and I have been known to listen to it.
But well, that's a above and beyond the call of duty, given that you already know how the sausage is made.
But you and Justin published this book of interviews with Mr. Matt Farley, which got to be the first piece of Farley literature.
Well, you know, I've said this before, I think, but the idea of doing that book was amusing to me because I was feeling not great about my career at that moment. You know, my other career before podcasting took over fully. And I thought, wouldn't it be funny to do a book for no audience? That would be to put that much work into a book for no one. And I was inspired by Farley and Roxburgh themselves that they made this whole cinematic universe for no one, basically. And as it turns out,
for them and their friends, yeah, to have fun. But
and as it turns out, the book has found an audience and keeps selling, which I feel happy about. But anyway, this article in the New York Times, which on the website it's called "Why Did This Guy Put a Song About Me on Spotify?" This journalist found that among the 25,000 songs, there is a song about him, because one of the things that Farley does is, you know, just write songs, improvise songs about every celebrity under the sun, celebrities, para-celebrities, minor celebrities, you know, in addition to search engine optimization songs about words that people search for, you know, animals, foods, poop. There's a song that he did called The Poop Song.
That has like birthday songs, yeah, like around people's names.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. The article is friendly enough. The fact that it notes that his movies have some culty letterboxed popularity, I take as a win personally. I think this is not the first Matt Farley profile, but the fact that they now have to acknowledge the movies is a combined win for all of us, I think. We did it. But there were a couple of things in this article that leapt out at me. I mean, to the journalist, understandably, Farley is kind of a curiosity. He writes, "Mostly I was trying to figure out whether I thought Farley was a bad guy. Did his scheme represent the inevitable cynical end product of a culture in the grips of algorithmic platforms? Or might it be a delightful side effect?"
Has he seen a Matt Farley film?
Was his work spam or a kind of outsider art? Was he just the poop song guy, or was he closer to Steve Keen, the Brooklyn-based Gen X hipster-approved painter of over 300,000 works who has been the subject of books and museum retrospectives? Later on, he writes, "Farley's business model rests on the sheer bulk of his output, and so does his artistic model. Whatever the dubious value of any individual song in the Farley universe, it's as part of this enormous body of the whole, the magnum opus, that it gains power. This is especially true when you consider that an artificial intelligence could conceivably produce 24,000 songs, Farley's entire oeuvre, in about a day, a fact that gives his defiantly human, even artisanal labor a kind of lonely, Sisyphean dignity. Whatever else Farley's work is, it is not AI, even when it barely seems to be I." I'm not crazy about that little joke at the end. But finally, the article sort of reaches its crescendo when it says, Farley represents both the best and worst of the incentives and opportunities that have taken this world's place. Certainly, there are few creators working today in any medium who would not recognize the anxiety he embodies, that their work now lives or dies by the vagaries of opaque algorithms serving a bottomless menu of options to an increasingly distracted public. And that if they don't bow to the demands of these new realities, their work, and by extension they, will simply disappear. Which is to say that while the experience of watching Farley work was not unpainful, as promised, neither was it totally unfamiliar. The bit where he asks whether he was certain or not that Farley was a bad guy leapt out at me as kind of strange. And there have been a lot of profiles of Farley over the years, and I think the ones that are the most skeptical of him are directly proportional to the size of the media outlet that produces them. Certainly, there is a lot of, algorithmically generated spam out there. I think both an admirer and a detractor of somebody like Farley would probably agree that his career, the part of his career that makes money, that is, because the movies do not make money, but the songs represent a sort of glitch in the matrix. And also that his career is a sort of testament to the fact that something in the system is broken.
It's better that we have, non-AI generated, pop music, like most of the top 40, which is all, created by songwriting auteurs and not written by committee or by computer.
Of course. There's a sort of suspicion here, and maybe I'm being unfair to the article, but a sort of an ambient suspicion that I think is unwarranted of, is he gaming the system somehow? Is this cheating in some way? Well, first of all, I like his novelty songs. I think they're united by a certain sensibility.
But I'm not really understanding this whole kind of line of attack, if you want, because the whole point of the songs is to subsidize the films, which are unique and special.
Absolutely.
No one could accuse them of being AI generated, even if you don't like them.
And also, like, okay, let's say this is a scam. Let's say there's a scam going on here. It's the most time-consuming scam in the world to make 25,000 songs that get you a middle-class income. Let's say that his career represents a reality that something in the system is broken. Well, what is that break and what is that system? Is the break that somebody has figured out that if they make 25,000 songs and get a couple pennies on each one, they get a middle-class income? Or is the break that you have these platforms like Spotify that are built on thievery, are built on not paying royalties?
Are built on forcing people to release, like, fucking 5 albums a year or whatever, because that's the only way to make any money now.
The whole central concept of his movie Local Legends, which is, how do you be an artist in this society? How do you have time for your creativity? Let's say you're a creative person and that's the most important thing in the world to you. Society is built to keep you from being that person, unless your dad owns a record company, unless you're one of those people. Unless you can afford to move to New York and your dad gets you a meeting with whatever titan of the record industry is in New York. I'm rather perplexed, frankly, by this genre of article that only seems to come out of a place like the New York Times that treats somebody like him with a healthy skepticism and not as a sort of triumph of the human spirit, frankly.
Yeah, check out our episode on that. I can't remember if that was a Patreon episode or not. If you're interested in watching a Matt Farley film, I mean, the one that will used to introduce me to, Farleyism was Local Legends, which is kind of an autobiographical film in which Matt Farley is kind of riffing on his own career trajectory and sort of playing a version of himself. You're going to be a little confused for the first few minutes, and then once you figure out what it's doing, I mean, I thought it was great. I thought it was incredible.
Oh, Timothy Chalamet, I really want to be your friend. Call me on the phone sometime so we can be friends. Timothy Chalamet, let me give you my phone number, 603-644-0048.
Anyway, rest in peace, Joe Lieberman, by the way. We somehow didn't mention that. Yeah. We're a few weeks removed from the news cycle.
Yeah, no segue there. We just recorded an episode last week, maybe a few hours before it was announced that, one of my political heroes had passed away. Everyone talks about, what might have been if the hanging chads in Florida had gone a different way and Al Gore had been president. I'm just weeping that Joe Lieberman never got to be VP.
And then in 2008.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely incredible. I mean, we don't need to spend too much time talking about Joe Lieberman. I think anyone listening to this podcast probably has an idea of what we think of the man. I do think as a figure, he's kind of unique. You know, I'm not sure anyone has been quite so emblematic of, you know, the rotten bipartisan consensus that has reigned in D.C. or largely reigned for the last 30 years. I mean, in some ways, he's one of the best to ever do it. He is a man who, in the span of 8 years, came closer than anyone, to my knowledge, ever has to being on the presidential tickets of both major parties. One of my favorite John McCain facts, you still see people bringing it up, like a certain type of person on Twitter will bring this up as something that, you know, is supposed to testify to John McCain's virtue and, like, you know, what might have been, that apparently McCain regretted it till the end of his days that he chose Sarah Palin rather than Joe Lieberman as his running mate in 2008. Think of how things might have been different. I'm sure that would have stopped Obama in his tracks to have to contend with Joe Lieberman. Anyway, my colleague Branko Markotic wrote a profile of Joe Lieberman back in 2018, and there's an anecdote in here that I just absolutely loved. Branko writes, when Lieberman entered Congress, Strom Thurmond told him, "I understand we think a lot alike in the ways we do things." "Yes, I think we do," replied Lieberman. Yeah, just a guy right there who believed in bipartisanship to his very core. And, you know, I'm tempted to wrap things here because, you know, who cares about Joe Lieberman? But in the spirit of our podcast, this actually makes me recall one of my favorite episodes we ever did, probably back in something like 2018 now, which was that Netroots documentary, which was about the Ned Lamont primary challenge to Joe Lieberman.
Oh, God. You know, just in the present context of just seeing, like, this massive protest movement in response to what's happening in Gaza in the face of officials like laughing in our faces, basically. And then you look back 15 to 20 years ago and look at like what the sanctioned activism was.
That movie presented the Netroots guys and Markotic Milicis is like, this is the left populist edge.
Yeah,
this is the youth protest movement. And they went and found this like centrist governor and convinced him to primary Joe Lieberman. Was like, can you just say you're against the Iraq war? And then they won by doing posts on something called the World Wide Web. And then what's so great about that documentary is Lieberman just ran as an independent and he cleaned their clocks anyway. Fucking amazing.
Good for him,
honestly.
I love
that documentary. Yeah. If ever there was a greater parable for the futility of a certain kind of like feckless, extremely online liberalism, I've never seen it. Love that movie. Well, we've got a great film to talk about on this week's episode, but there was one more thing I wanted to talk about off the top. This is also somewhat belated. I think the news was announced last week that the convicted fraudster Sam Bankman-Fried, this came out, I think, before his sentencing, but the question is no longer, you know, whether he's going to spend time in jail. It's just, you know, how much time is he going to spend in jail? And I thoroughly enjoyed an op-ed in The Guardian by Aditya Chakraborty, who, in my opinion, easily one of the best Guardian writers, you know, a newspaper columnist who I consistently enjoy, have enjoyed for years, big fan of his writing. And I think one of the reasons I'm underscoring this so much is there's not many op-ed columnists in the English-speaking world who I could say that about. I think the op-ed pages to which I periodically contribute myself, I think they mostly suck, regardless of the paper or the, you know, the ideological orientation of the paper. Anyway, Aditya Chakraborty wrote this column, "Sam Bankman-Fried will grow old in jail, but don't forget those who basked in his orbit." And I'm not going to run through the whole piece. You know, he spends time kind of running through the Sam Bankman-Fried scandal. Accompanying the article is this wonderful photo, I think one of the defining photos of our age, I think you'll agree well, of Sam Bankman-Fried with Bill Clinton and Tony Blair on stage. I believe this was just in 2022, not that long ago. This was at some kind of Caribbean summit or something that he convened, and I think he just offered them a whole bunch of money. Sam Bankman-Fried, notably, they're in suits, but he's just wearing, you know, shorts and a t-shirt. He looks pretty scruffy. It's a power move, too, because as I think Aditya points out in this article, like, he's the one who's convened this meeting. Like, he's where power actually lies. Anyway, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried is somebody who's interested me in much the same way that Adam What's-His-Name from WeWork, we did a whole episode on him a while back with Wendy Liu. You know, a lot of these kind of modern scams, you know, Elizabeth Holmes, Theranos, that kind of thing. I'm very interested in these scams precisely because it seems to me they're so obviously scams. It was the same thing with, you know, just cryptocurrency in general and that whole boom, NFT. NFTs, which really seem to just be coasting off of the fumes of crypto. For me, the details of these scams are often less interesting than the fact that this is what the average kind of tech scam is now. Like that it's this, you know, these ersatz forms of innovation where in retrospect, sure, but even at the time, you kind of look at the information that was available to people and you kind of think like, how did billions of dollars get sunk into X or Y? And I don't know, I've always thought that Aditya Chakraborty has a special talent for summing up this kind of thing very simply and concisely. He writes at the end of the piece, as Galbraith, he's talking about John Kenneth Galbraith, who he's quoted a few paragraphs above, as Galbraith makes clear, financial crimes aren't purveyed only by evil masterminds. They're licensed by entire societies who believe in them until they don't. Bankman-Fried's great fall from grace began shortly after the U.S. interest rates began marching upwards in the summer of 2022. In many ways, his story is of how an entire decade of cheap money and high hopes for a new economic paradigm was squandered. His crimes are his own to atone for, but his disgrace is the disgrace of a much larger financial and political establishment. The old guard spent years waiting for a new savior to come along and rescue them from the doldrums of the banking crash. When a boy pulled up in a battered Corolla, they got in without asking too many questions. I think that's exactly right. I think it's very well put. And it's really getting at the only way that I feel like I can account for this kind of scam artist and how they ever, you know, accrue millions of dollars or do events with Bill Clinton and, you know, are feted in Davos or whatever. As that Guardian piece argues, and as, you know, many people have correctly recognized about Sam Bankman-Fried and so many other scam artists in the same vein, yeah, they're fraudsters as individuals, but there's a whole elite machinery that exists to kind of legitimize and enable them, from people like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair and their stupid institutes to, you know, the kind of credulous reporting that gives these people long-winded puff treatments about how, you know, they're the voice of a generation, they're the greatest innovator in the 21st century, yada yada. But that to me is only part of the explanation. I feel like a Sam Bankman-Fried or Elizabeth Holmes has to ultimately be also tapping into something deeper. You know, I can complain all I want about the many puff pieces that have been written about a guy like this or about Elon Musk or whoever, but the fact is there is an audience for those things. I think there is a genuine cultural yearning for figures like this. And well, on our Patreon episode this week, we're having one of the many conversations that we've come to have on the show about how sclerotic everything in our culture and society feels. And I mean, in the case of this, as in the case of so many other things we talk about on this show, this is really the only way I'm able to account for any of this. How anybody, like notwithstanding the elite machinery that legitimizes a Sam Bankman-Fried, to me, the only thing that can really ultimately explain any of this is that in a sclerotic culture, there is a latent desire for novelty and for anything that can cast itself as progressive, transformative, even just new. You know, however fraudulently things may do that, we as a culture crave things that are game-changing. And in an age where any hope for kind of a public version of that has collapsed, you know, for something that comes out of, you know, mass politics, which are largely dead or dormant, that comes out of the democratic sphere, like there isn't really a feeling right now, particularly as that passage I read, you know, I think it was referring to this. In some ways, you can look at a Sam Bankman-Fried as emblematic in many ways of a decade where there were these alternative possibilities that mass politics was going to be resurrected. Those things in many ways defined the 2010s, though ultimately the 2010s were defined not only by the emergence of those things, but by the thwarting of them as well. So in the wake of all that, I just think you get an ersatz version of it. You get these narratives of transformation and progress and change that are located in the private sector, that are structured around these like absurd technological gimmicks, which like, say what we want about Elon Musk. At least what he said for years was like, I'm going to build cities on Mars or whatever. Like Sam Bankman-Fried's scam is so many rungs beneath that in terms of like the utopian possibility of it or what that was supposed to be. Same with crypto, same with NFTs.
What's funny about something like crypto was built into it was the assumption that society has failed and here is a workaround. Like, well, you're not going to get rich the old-fashioned way because that's been shut off from you. But hey, maybe if you roll the dice on this, it's not forging new frontiers. It's like creating a parallel like workaround.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, if that is not emblematic of how sclerotic and paralyzed everything is and how sclerotic and atrophied everything is, I don't know what is, because like we're only talking about a, you know, 10 or so year period here in which there's been a decline, even of the quality of what these scams are and what the fake promise that they're built around contends to be. Like even the bullshit fantasies of this society somehow manage to suck. Even the scams manage to suck.
Well, folks, speaking of scams, here are some scams of our own. It's our plug section, patreon.com/Michael and Us. Our Patreon episode this week is a much requested title, oft requested. It is the classic, quintessential 70s paranoia thriller, The Parallax View.
Neither of us had ever seen this film before. I don't know why I'd had some reservation about watching it, but thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought we had a great discussion.
Also, a quick personal plug. If you find yourself in the city of Toronto on April 16th, why not mosey on over to the Fox Theater? You can see me introduce a Japanese giant monster movie, and not just any, the 1980 film Gamera Super Monster. Y'all like Godzilla, right? What if I told you that Tokyo has its second best monster, Gamera, a giant flying turtle, friend of all children? And this movie is the wildest, the craziest, the most ridiculous of the Gamera movies. You get to see him fight all of his classic foes. Guiron, Gaios, Baragon, the whole gang's here. Gamera on the big screen, folks. And you'll be able to accost me and ask me any questions you want to. But what if I told you that there's an even bigger scam? It's called unions, folks. Because they get in the way of you and your employer sorting out a fair deal that works for you. Isn't that right, Luke?
In the United States of America, most people's god is the motor car. Some even worship the corporations that make the cars. Chrysler, Ford, General Motors. And the greatest of these is General Motors, the heart of whose empire is the city of Flint in Michigan. Flint is a company town and has been for more than half a century. Behold Flint, where the workers are well paid, well organized. Now, that is. But what a fight it took.
Well, it's been a while since we've done a labor movie. This is one that I discovered quite by chance. I thought it was very good. I've been doing some research on the 1937 Flint sit-down strike. And in the footnotes of various books, I kept seeing this 1976 BBC documentary called The Great Sit-Down, which was done by a program called Yesterday's Witness.
This is like a spin-off called Yesterday's Witness in America.
So this is an hour-long documentary. It's freely available on YouTube. We will link to it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It is a very good rundown of the events of this strike, which is really one of, if not the foundational event in the history of industrial unionism in North America. The strike began on December 30th, 1936, and ended 7 weeks later in February. There were sit-downs all over America, but GM, which was at the time the biggest corporation anywhere in the world, they had concentrated so much of their production in Detroit, which was at the time just the leading industrial center for all of America, not just with auto manufacturing. But Flint was even more key. To say that it was a company town at the time would actually be understating the case. There's a Depression-era novel by a writer called Catherine Brody called Nobody Starves I came across, and in that a character says of Flint that the company owns the town. That was, to a certain extent, quite literally true. So this documentary tells the story of those 7 critical weeks in which the UAW, which was, you know, in the 1930s, only been founded in the mid-1930s, it was a kind of disparate collection of locals that were not very powerful. This documentary tells the story of how the UAW and the workers in Flint and elsewhere won recognition from the company by bringing production to a halt. Most pieces of labor history like this are David and Goliath stories, but that is especially true of the Flint sit-down strike. This is a not very powerful trade union with limited organization, storming one of the citadels of corporate power in America and winning a kind of legal recognition that helps in the post-war period essentially create the American middle class.
I was aware of the Flint sit-down strike ambiently, well, probably thanks to Michael Moore, frankly, but I was grateful to this documentary for showing exactly how it was accomplished, as well as the very real stakes of the strike. Obviously, there had been strikes, but it seems to me like one at this scale with this potential risk was unprecedented, in at least in an American context. And this would have come at a moment coming out of the Great Depression when there would have been a flurry of labor activity. So I'm assuming that this strike would have been one that really put a lot of the progress made in the decade to the test.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The strike notably follows on the heels of the 1936 presidential election, in which Franklin Delano Roosevelt wins this, you know, massive landslide in Michigan. Governor Francis Murphy kind of rides the coattails of that. He has a much closer election. He wins by something like 47,000 votes, unseating the Republican incumbent. And he does so more or less by explicitly courting workers and labor. He speaks even to small labor gatherings. Francis Murphy is a very interesting person in his own right. He's a key actor in the strike. In fact, one of the only criticisms, not really a criticism, but a piece of the story that I think is somewhat missing from this 76 BBC documentary is the central role Murphy himself played. Ultimately, a number of things come together to produce the strike in 1937, but also to produce the victorious outcome, which the UAW secures. There's this wider climate of labor militancy during the New Deal. The conditions in the factories, goes without saying, are absolutely horrendous, but there's also been a decline in the wages and the working conditions of auto workers in particular, other kinds of workers as well, of course, throughout the Great Depression. There have been a ton of layoffs as well. GM is a very profitable company. It had total assets in 1936 of $1.5 billion. So that's in 1936 money. As I said, biggest corporation in the world. I think about 37% of the cars in the global auto market were made by GM. It had 60 plants in 35 cities in 14 states. It had over 170,000 annual employees, over 47,000 of which were concentrated in Flint in December of 1936, which also had Fisher Body One, the biggest auto plant anywhere in the world. So you have this wider political climate, you have this climate of labor militancy, you have the UAW and its organizers taking this huge risk, trying to organize in Flint, which is this citadel of General Motors. General Motors spent millions of dollars during the 1930s, and again, this is in 1930s money, to suppress worker organization, particularly in the wake of the Wagner Act passed in 1935, which kind of lays the groundwork for the official recognition of trade unions.
Quite a bit of espionage, too. A lot of paid spies.
Oh, yeah. Pinkertons. I mean, when the UAW first went into Flint in 1936, they couldn't buy radio airtime. You know, the organizing conditions were absolutely horrendous. And nevertheless, they succeeded.
The documentary, even in under an hour long, is quite comprehensive in detailing the conditions that led to the strike. Although, notably, the narrator says, the actual pretext for calling that strike is hardly remembered now, nor is it specially relevant. The hundreds of men who sat down that day did so in general protest at their atrocious working conditions. You having researched this a little more, was there a shooting of the Archduke Ferdinand moment here?
Well, I believe the instigating incidents were actually some unplanned sit-downs that started in December. And at a certain point, the organizers basically just had to pull the trigger. That's my understanding at this point. But I mean, the UAW had actually been putting off, you know, they were waiting because Francis Murphy was going to be sworn in as governor on January the 1st. And they knew that he was both a potential ally, but also that he'd only gotten to the governor's office by courting organized labor. So they were going to have leverage over him as well. The UAW actually, when the election happened, explicitly framed it, not just Murphy's election, Roosevelt's as well, as a defeat for GM. And they had the slogan, you voted New Deal at the polls and defeated the auto barons, now get a New Deal in the shop. Now, Murphy, as I said, he's a very interesting character historically. It would be wrong to say that, you know, he single-handedly delivered UAW the victory, although it's hard to imagine the victory happening or happening when it did, if not for his interventions. And though there was a certain amount of self-interest in that, because, you know, Murphy actually had, he was an ambitious guy, he had presidential ambitions, possibly for 1940. He, you know, might have wanted to be reelected as governor as well. And, you know, he knew who delivered his relatively narrow victory in the 36 election. But nonetheless, Frank Murphy was very sympathetic to workers and to organized labor. In fact, when he was a student at the University of Michigan, an undergraduate, he wrote a paper, which among other things said this: if I can only feel when my day is done that I've accomplished something towards uplifting the poor, uneducated, unfortunate 10-hour-a-day worker from the political chaos he now exists in, I will be satisfied that I've been worthwhile. Now, while the Flint sit-down strikers and, you know, the UAW organizers, you know, recognized they had leverage over Murphy, they did really seem to see him as an ally as well. There's one UAW lawyer that I found quoted as saying, employers controlled everything in the state except Murphy. We'll come back to the documentary and the strike in a moment, but just to get Murphy's role out of the way, what typically happened with strikes in the 1930s and before that is, you know, people picket, and then, you know, the company sometimes doesn't even have to call the cops. They just hire Pinkertons. They hire like literal goons, thugs. And if you're picketing, that's just legally considered trespassing. And they ask you to leave. And if you don't leave, they beat you up. And maybe they don't even ask. Organizers are intimidated. They're disappeared. They're beaten up, whatever. Murphy, as you can imagine, is frequently, you know, he's under frequent pressure to simply evict the sit-down strikers. And important to say here, you know, a sit-down strike is, it's a very particular kind of tactic. You know, you don't picket, you just sit down at your machine and you stop working. So it becomes very violent. It requires even more violence to actually evict you, which is why the strike was so effective. And you don't need every worker in a plant to sit down. This is auto manufacturing in the 30s. So the way production is structured, you just have to disrupt various choke points, many of which are located in these key plants, Fisher 1, Fisher 2, Chevy 9, Chevy 4, which is another plant that's described later in the documentary. Murphy does call in the National Guard, but believe it or not, you know, there's various worker testimonies from the time in which people were actually quite relieved to see the National Guard turning up and setting, I know this sounds very alien to modern ears, but setting up machine gun nests on Chevrolet Avenue, which was the key artery in Flint. And the reason for that is that the National Guard were essentially forming a line between the sit-down strikers and the company goons. So the sit-down strikers could not be evicted. The way Frank Murphy himself talked about this kind of in all of his public rhetoric was, we're not taking sides here. We just don't want there to be violence. We don't want there to be civil strife. We want there to be a peaceful solution. But the fact is, his quote-unquote neutral interventions in this strike were really an explicit example of the state intervening, of executive power in this case, intervening on the side of workers. There's another instance in which GM cut off power and electricity and heat and blockaded the plant so the food couldn't get in. And Murphy called GM, told them to turn the heat back on, and then requisitioned state food agencies to deliver food aid to the striking workers at the plant, again, without which the strike probably would not have had the same outcome.
These men had work, but they had no sick benefits, no overtime pay, no pension scheme, no holiday pay, no unemployment pay. If the production line stopped, you waited without pay until it was mended, and you didn't protest.
That if you complain, then they take you to the window up the street was the employment office. So you see all them fellas looking for your job? Keep your mouth shut or you're going to join them.
So the documentary follows the strike from cradle to grave. It takes place over 7 weeks. The first month is largely confined to one plant. But in the second month, they infiltrate Plant 4 in the Chevrolet complex, which is where the engines were made, one of the most essential ones. And it was that capture that really stopped the functioning of the Chevrolet plant. As the film goes along, you learn a lot about the logistics of the strike. You see groups of allies forming, bringing shipments of food and having them carried through the windows for the striking workers. There are groups like this Women's Auxiliary, made up largely but not entirely of the wives of the striking workers, who, as the story goes along, become a paramilitary force. Actually, they become
just brawling with cops.
They're ready to fight this Women's Auxiliary.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things I like about this documentary is that it's mostly structured around testimony from eyewitnesses, most of whom are workers who were there,
as well as the leader of the Women's Auxiliary too.
Yes, so this is Janora Johnson, who was 23 at the time. Fair to say, I think, a legendary labor activist, one of the founders of the Flint chapter of the Socialist Party USA. I think she probably has the most speaking time of any of the talking heads in this movie, any of the interviewees.
So we sent women out to talk to the wives of these men who were having problems at home. And many of them came down and worked with us after the women went out and explained what it would mean to their family budget, to the health of the family.
You know, she relates a number of colorful anecdotes. For example, she describes one of the tactics that the company used to try to turn public sentiment against the sit-downers, which was to have goons go around door to door telling all of the families that, they're just having orgies in the plants. You know, they're drinking. They've got burlesque dancers. They're all lying around on, like, plush beds with cushions. And, you know, you women, you have it rough. You're doing all the sacrificing. And your husbands are just going to wind up being fired for this.
That's just one of the human costs of the strike. You learn that workers are becoming delinquent on their house payments. Some of them are losing their furniture. Some of them are losing their cars. In addition to negotiating with GM, strike leaders have to negotiate with the actual finance companies, putting pressure on them to lay off lest they lose business in the future once the union is recognized. And of course, the strike is happening with no guarantee that the union will be recognized and no guarantee that if it is, the rabble-rousers, the strike organizers, won't be fired.
If people want to read a good book on the strike, there's a late historian by the name of Sidney Fine who wrote a book, Sit Down, which is excellent, that chronicles the strike in great detail. We obviously don't have the bandwidth to do that here. There's been a lot that's written about the strike. It's been endlessly kind of analyzed and deconstructed over the years. But the BBC documentary wisely structures itself around two key incidents. One, which is an event subsequently known as the Battle of the Running Bulls, which occurred on January the 11th. This occurred when the Flint police, this is the local police, tried to dislodge the people sitting down at Fisher number 2. The guards blocked food aid and cut off the heat. They then called the Flint police. And what followed that evening was, essentially an armed confrontation between supporters of the strike and the local police. This is before the National Guard have been called in. Janora Johnson, talking about this event, you know, relates some more funny stuff. She talks about grabbing a microphone. She was operating on this evening as a kind of field commander. She's, you know, rallying the troops with the microphone. She's calling the cops cowards. And at one point, she rallies the women's auxiliary who are all carrying, you know, clubs and other things, and they just break through the police line and the police have to retreat. Now, it's this incident. Frank Murphy in Lansing gets wind of what's happening, and this is the incident that precipitates his calling in of the National Guard. In his public statements in the next 2 days, he explains his calling in of the National Guard and the instructions they have by basically saying, no violence is going to be committed to, quote, add terror to the existing economic demonstration. Privately, he tells various people that the troops are going to protect the people on strike inside and outside the plants, and that they're going to prevent the ejection of the sit-down strikers by local authorities. Now, the next key incident that Will's alluded to already is the capture of Plant 4, which involves the UAW and its organizers initiating a kind of feint, essentially by leaking phony information to a place where they know the company's spies will pick it up, which says that they're about to initiate an attempt to capture Chevrolet Plant 9, except Chevrolet Plant 9 was not the target. Plant 4, which was the much more crucial one in terms of disrupting the overall assembly of the car, that was the real target, and it's the capture of Plant 4 that really allows the UAW to reclaim the initiative in the strike and leads to the ultimate victory on February the 11th.
One testimonial that surprised me was when one of the workers said he was surprised by how long the strike took. There was an assumption, at least among some of the strikers, that, well, you know, this will go for a week, maybe 2 weeks, and it'll be both so embarrassing for the company and so disruptive for them that they'll be forced to acquiesce. But it was surprising the sheer extent to which GM was recalcitrant towards this, to the point of losing millions and millions of dollars. Precluding union was a greater investment than the short-term loss of millions of dollars.
I mean, at this point, various big employers and kind of corporate lobbies were contesting the constitutionality of the Wagner Act at the Supreme Court. They knew that various legislation introduced during the 1930s was potentially laying the groundwork for a different kind of labor relations in which they were not going to have the same kind of power over their workforce. And yeah, the thing that they were fearing the most in many ways was having to recognize individual unions as, you know, the exclusive voice of workers in a particular industry or for a particular company. I want to just provide a little more context for the sit-down tactic in particular. As I understand it, this kind of started to come in vogue in the mid-1930s. Sidney Fine, the historian, explains the utility of the tactic this way, which I think provides some context as to why it played such a key part of this strike. Because of the closely interrelated processes of automobile production, a small group of automobile workers could tie up a large factory by closing down a few key departments, and they could paralyze even a major producer by stopping production in a few strategic plants that fabricated parts upon which its other plants depended. All of this could be accomplished by a minority of workers in a given plant or a given company. Sit-downs, I think, as I said earlier, were also harder to disperse because, you know, if you send in company goons and people are sitting at their machines, like, the machinery might be damaged. The optics of going into a plant where people are just sitting there and, like, wrenching them off the ground and beating them up are even worse than, like, doing that to workers on a traditional picket.
Could you clear up for me a little bit the exact conditions that led to the end of the strike? Because obviously there's a new governor. I understand that Roosevelt was putting pressure on the resolution of the strike somehow, and the workers got everything they wanted, up to and including the strike organizers not being punished. I mean, after all that, how did they get such a good deal?
Well, I think the capture of Plant 4 and the kind of just total grinding to a halt of production really did give the upper hand to UAW. I think the focus became now on, maybe we can limit the use of the sit-down as a tactic. Like, maybe UAW will agree to give that up. Like, if we can just get people out of the plants and we'll give them this legal recognition, then, you know, we can live to fight another day. You know, otherwise this might go on and we might have communism, which, by the way, I mean, this whole incident, particularly the role of the National Guard and Frank Murphy, is still apparently quite traumatic on the right. I was looking up something at the Ayn Rand Institute, or just like the way they talk about it. I mean, think about how upsetting the Flint sit-down strike and then, you know, the role of the Michigan executive is. Think about how upsetting that is to, like, the, you know, right wing or like the libertarian sensibility in particular. From a right-wing point of view, workers who are sitting down are like literally trespassers, right? Private property is sacrosanct. So workers who go on strike are literally thugs, right? Management has total discretion and authority. That's scary enough that they're sitting down and like nothing's being done about it. Then the governor sends in the National Guard and like won't let local police and hired goons by the company like come and just like kill people. Like, it does seem that parts of the right at the time, the hard right reactionary wing of American business, was basically like, okay, this is the beginning of communism in the United States. But so the sit down tactic, importantly, was kind of loathed by like Roosevelt didn't like it. Frank Murphy didn't like it. Perkins, Frank Murphy's labor secretary, she didn't like it either. But all of them, it seems, particularly Murphy and Perkins, were quite averse to there being any violent resolution to the strike. That was partly out of conviction and partly political self-interest. Now, later, the Supreme Court upheld aspects of the Wagner Act of 1935, but it did also strike down the legality of the sit-down strike, though it, you know, later lived on in the civil rights movement in particular as a tactic.
Well, the movie ends on a triumphant note. The surviving members of the sit-down strike are retired in relative comfort.
After the strike, my job was rated at $1.10 an hour, which was an increase of approximately 40 cents an hour. Whether the line broke down for a half an hour was of no significance, because I'd still make $1.10 an hour. And then if they decided there was a breakdown, they had to catch up on production, and they had to run an hour over. They had to pay us a time and a half. Before that, we didn't get paid. It was a gratuitous thing. We just did it for free.
Today, I'm sitting here with over $600 a month pension. It all came through organized labor. At my old age, I'm able to sit around and do what I want to. They got 40 years of me down there, the best of my life. And now I'm able to enjoy a little bit of it I'm getting. And if we hadn't made good, we wouldn't have had nothing. We had to do it. We had to do it.
So it ends on a triumphant note, but the beginning can't help but feel heartbreaking, given what has happened in the decades since. The narration, of course, begins, Flint is a company town and has been for half a century. Well, not anymore. And, you know, I couldn't help but be reminded of that scene in Roger and Me, the parade scene, where some of the survivors of the Flint sit-down strike are on a float together. The governor, the mayor, whoever else is in the parade are all praising them, and Moore keeps asking, like, well, what do you, given the layoffs happening right now, do you think we should have another sit-down strike? And they all say, you know what? Times are different. You know, it's not quite, I don't know if it's quite right now. And yeah, they did find a way to beat the unions, didn't they? They lost the battle, but they sure won a war.
I mean, the bludgeoning of the American labor movement and the labor movement in general, the absolutely sclerotic and top-heavy economic paradigm that we all inhabit today, its existence is coterminous with the destruction of the labor movement. It's really no more complicated than that. I would be remiss to not mention that another one of the talking heads in the film is one Victor Reuther. The three Reuther brothers, famous icons of the American labor movement, were all involved in the strike. Victor Reuther, less famous than his brother Walter, but has in common with them that in the 1940s, both of them survived, I believe, multiple assassination attempts. It's funny, since we just watched the Parallax View for our other episode, I'll just note that I don't think even though the police were nominally involved in investigating those crimes, the assailants were ever found, despite there being plenty of eyewitnesses, and I don't think those crimes were ever solved.
Well, I said a few minutes ago that GM lost a lot of battles but won the war, but we would be remiss not to note the recent UAW strike that ended in October with some significant victories for General Motors workers in the United States. Curious, Luke, what sort of resonances you see between that and what we see in this film about the Flint sit-down strike?
Well, I do think it was notable last fall that, you know, even Trump kind of sort of had to pretend like he was supporting the UAW. I mean, there was that whole ridiculous news cycle where Trump was going to hold a rally at a non-union shop, like not with UAW workers, and various media organizations were like, you know, Donald Trump is parking his tanks like straight on, like, you know, the Democrats' front lawn or whatever. That was all pretty ridiculous. But I do think, you know, it is notable that this strike is kind of so formative in American history that, you know, the right supposed workerists today have to kind of pretend to embrace it. Not just Trump, but, you know, doofuses like Josh Hawley as well.
Well, one of the rare good news days of the Joe Biden presidency was that he became, what, the first American president to march in a picket line. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I believe that's true. You know, and it was quite significant. And of course, you know, Biden has been distinguishing himself so much since that day.
I know that Biden often sort of positions himself as a pro-worker president, pro-working class, you know, that's like part of his affect.
He does say pro-labor, to be fair. That is the frame that he likes to use.
But it's interesting, and I don't know why this is the case, but it's interesting that after decades of, you know, anti-union rhetoric, after decades of Clintonism, after decades of unions being systematically weakened across North America, this was the moment when it became politically toxic for somebody like Trump to be bluntly anti-union, and it was politically advantageous for somebody like Biden to march on a picket line. I'm not quite sure why now.
There are a lot of ways to explain that, I think. One of the most basic things is just that there's a lot more public support for unions than there has been for decades. I believe it was Gallup, which found, I can't remember what year the poll was, in the last year or two, certainly recent, that public approval for unions was, I believe, at the highest they'd ever recorded since they started recording it in the early 1960s, I think. I'm sure public approval, if it could have been measured, would have been higher before that, but nonetheless, you know, incredibly significant. And, you know, obviously approval or disapproval of a particular institution, it's kind of a broad and general thing. But I do think one reading of that incredible Gallup statistic is just that there's a wider recognition, a kind of an ambient public recognition that the, you know, political economic sentiment of the past, you know, 30 or 40 years has really not delivered on its key promises. In particular, you know, all of the outsourcing, all of the economic transformations of the 1980s and 90s. So, you know, a country like the United States, economy like the United States, really shifting away from manufacturing, becoming a much more service-based economy that doesn't really make things anymore in the same way. You know, I think there was an idea, or it was heavily insinuated for a long time that, yeah, hey, this transformation's going to be painful. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is how you create a widely shifted shared, you know, broadly shared prosperity. It's just not what happened. You know, people know that that's not what happened. I think that's been clear since the 1990s, but I think it's been increasingly clear since the financial crisis of 2008 and all of the, recriminations since then. And I guess maybe if I can just try to end the conversation on an optimistic note, you know, the conditions today are very different. The kind of industrial unionism, which played such an important and formative role in the mid-20th century, many of the sectors that need to be organized, much of the work that's done today is just of a different nature. And so organizing in those environments is very different. That's a whole other conversation that we don't have time to get into. But thinking back to the 1930s and how rapidly things changed, I mean, from passage of the Wagner Act in 1935 and the foundation of UAW, you know, which begins as, I think, as we've said, just as a series of kind of disparate and not very powerful locals to, within a few years, taking on the biggest company in the world and winning recognition and then going on to change the landscape of labor relations, not just in the automotive sector, but the strike obviously plays a significant role in doing that more generally throughout America. No matter how bleak things seem, things can change, and when they do, they often change very, very fast.
Sit down, just take a seat, sit down and rest your feet, sit down, you gotta be, sit down,
when the speed up comes, just twiddle your thumb,
sit down, sit down,
when you want them to know, they better go slow,
sit down,
sit down,
sit down, just take a seat, sit down and rest your feet, sit down, you gotta be, sit down, sit down.
When the boss don't talk, don't take a walk.
Sit down, sit down.
When the boss sees that, he'll want to chat.
Sit down, sit down. Sit down, just take a seat. Sit down and rest your feet. Sit down, you've got to be. Sit down, sit down. Sit down and take a seat. Sit down.